Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 336 of the Roguecast, recorded June 15th, 2021, The Faithful Five.
We are back after a week off. Last week, there was just some chaos.
There's too much going on.
We may have more of that as time goes on. Summer, I know we'll have at least end of July, we'll have to miss an episode, or early August.
Yeah, and we hope that you, our faithful 10, will weather these ups and downs.
Dave, faithful 5.
Right? Whether it's Russell, Rob, or there's others. I know you're out there.
Clint,
yeah. I've talked to any number of people. I feel bad that I'm not remembering their names. They should email us their names, and then we can count their heads and be like, there's seven,
there's
guys.
There's seven people. The faithful seven.
Faithful seven. All right. So Randy, we have store news?
Yeah.
Or
so basically, there'll be 2 weeks for the comics, although last week was there wasn't a lot of new stuff.
Oh, you mean just what we're doing today?
And there will be, I've got 2 weeks worth of store news, which is basically, there was a lot of games the last couple weeks. So,
okay.
New brand of Warlock Tiles, which I don't know if people know about. They're like the terrain.
It's like D&D terrain that is like really a very high quality. Slightly pricey, but the people who've started picking them up have had no complaints.
Yeah, and they're doing they have sets with furniture and characters too. Like,
you can make some awesome.
They're really nice.
Yeah. So there's a couple new base sets for that. There is the Quests of Yore, which is an RPG.
Oh, yeah.
It's the RPG from Onward, the Pixar movie Onward.
Oh, yeah. Somebody saw that the other day, and I had not noticed it when it came in, so it was new to me. It
comes with, the books, and you get minis, and you get a cool adventure.
So wait,
cool.
Is it set in the Onward world, or is it, in the past
it's
of Onward?
It's the game that Barley plays.
Yes. Oh, okay. Interesting.
So it's a little weird, because we're basically two movies past it already, I think.
Two Pixar movies
past it. We're about to be, at least.
Wait a second. That came out in the pandemic.
Yeah. But Soul's already been out,
and Luca comes out on Friday.
Well, they just crank them out. They just need a buck, and they just knock out a movie.
I'm just saying, it's a little. This should have been out. We should be playing the Soul RPG right now.
I mean, I don't know if a game that's or a movie that's a year and a half old has necessarily gotten spoiled.
No, it's old.
I'm truly surprised there's not something from indie press that is like Soul.
Yeah,
I feel like that's rife for.
I guess I should watch that at some point. Randy, Onward is your granddad's Pixar.
Yeah.
Okay, that's.
Actually,
not what we're about now.
This does look super fun. I do think a shared Pixar universe RPG, though, would be a good thing. You should do that. They should make that.
Sure. I'm sure Disney's going to start doing RPGs soon.
Sure. Arkham Horror, the third edition board game, has the Secrets of the Order, a new expansion. There, speaking of new expansions, Magic is in the pre-release weekend right now, or pre-release week, I guess, of Modern Horizons 2.
Yes.
Which is their new, as I understand it, as they reprint popular and powerful cards.
Yeah.
They're a little more expensive, but you get expensive cards out of it.
Yeah. I know that we are out of the pre-release packs, but just using that as to test the water. Yeah. I know Anna bought one of them, and she said it was really, really a great buy.
Yep. And
the amount of stuff
boxes,
you got was great.
And then as of Friday, we'll have the set boosters available for individual sale. We got Happy Little Dinosaurs, which is another game from the guys who do Exploding Kittens and Unstable Unicorns and all that stuff. That seems to be doing well. We got Plague Inc., which is a new game that Asmodee is doing. It's not a new game. It's been around, but it was the first time we've had it. But it's basically the reverse pandemic. You're trying to build a disease to wipe out humanity.
I don't know that it's quite what I'm in the mood for after a year and a half of that shit. but this is one, Randy. Do we think this is the one that was based on that app?
Yes, I believe that is the case. It is based on the app where you're.
Yeah.
That my kid used to play.
Yeah, I remember hearing about it occasionally from customers. It sounded like a good game. So.
There's also a game. This is from. What are they called? The Stonemaier, the guys who do Wingspan and Scythe.
Mm-hmm.
They have a new game called Red Rising that is it's a hand management combo building game that I believe is based on a novel by Pierce Brown. I'm looking to see if it is in fact.
That is a combination of many factors.
So it is based on the future dystopian novel. And in this future dystopian, it is a. It's a futuristic riff on the Count of Monte Cristo.
Okay. Count of Monte Cristo is one of those stories that I have seen done. I feel like there's been there's a sci-fi version. What's the one that's got a comic right now? Oh, that's another classic property. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what the Count of Monte Cristo is. I don't know that story.
Oh, really? You don't?
Nope.
A guy gets wronged and then, like, is imprisoned for years and years, and there's always a very cool prison escape in it that, like, takes years to pull off.
Like, how's this different from the Man in the Iron Mask?
Man in the Iron Mask is a wrongfully imprisoned guy who I think gets, like, freed by the Three Musketeers.
Yes.
But
so
it's not
very similar is what I'm hearing.
I mean, it's the same writer, right?
Yeah,
it's Dumas.
It's Dumas. Yeah.
Yeah. There was but Count of Monte Cristo. Yeah,
it had a 90s era movie with Jim Caviezel.
Yeah,
it was actually
and
good.
Luis Guzman.
Mm-hmm.
Randy, I suspect I recommend catching that version. Who's the guy who plays the dude who trains him essentially?
I forget.
It's one
it's
of those
been
like
a long time
Ralph Richardson. No, not what's that guy's name? He's an old one of these old actors.
Richard Harrison.
It's like one of those guys.
Richard Harris.
Yes. Randy, I think you would like it. It has vibes of the 90s Zorro,
okay,
where there's right. like a master and apprentice. But he comes out and he like rebuilds his life so that he's like reestablishes his wealth to take his vengeance.
Okay,
and there's
right.
there it is built into it is sort of questions of like how far do you take your vengeance and what how far is too far?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is never far enough. It's a cool story.
Kobold had a couple press has a couple things. The Deep Magic Pocket Guide. Which
yeah.
is a 5e compatible.
Kobold mm-hmm. Press, who does some of the best like 5e type off-brand products, but you know, third party.
They do the Tome of Beasts and the Creature
yeah.
Codex.
Super high production.
Their
values.
Alternate World, which is actually based very heavily on sort of Norse stuff, Midgard World book that came out this mm-hmm. week. But they also have this Kobold Guide to Monsters, in which they found 15 like game. They say brightest stars in the gaming industry, like game designers and that kind of thing, who basically talk about how to build a monster and how to use adversaries effectively and that kind of thing. So it's basically a guide to building monsters and using monsters in D&D.
That's pretty cool.
And it looks pretty cool.
That sounds like the kind of thing they're quite good at, that sort of stuff,
yeah.
and those sort of in introspective yeah. thoughts on them.
Reminder that coming up here in about a month now, we have the Magic Forgotten Realms pre-release. That
yep.
will be a lock-in event. It will be the first time we've done an in-store pre-release since the pandemic. We're looking forward to that.
Yeah.
So that still plenty of room to sign up for that.
I just signed somebody up about 5 minutes ago.
And Free Comic Book Day is coming on August 14th. So it's we were wondering how we're going to do that. It seems like we've gotten to the point that people are going to be in. So it may be something akin to an old-school Free Comic Book Day, which is
yeah.
going to make all of us super nervous.
Yeah. Yeah, what we may find is just ways to kind of like keep things a little more dispersed or, you know, have a like some signs reminding people to keep at least some basic, a little
right.
bit more distance than usual.
I'm going to spray everyone with disease.
You know what would be cool? You know how like when cats are naughty and you spray them with a water bottle,
yeah,
like that's
yeah.
a little on the sprayer
yeah.
thing? Let's just keep those around.
I like it. Yeah.
It can't hurt in a paper product store, right?
Right, no. sounds like a great idea.
Randy, I sprayed the X-Men comic again.
all right. Let's talk news. We actually have 2 weeks of news to catch up on. Kind of a surprise, Why the Last Man, which has kind of been in development hell for a while,
yep.
Has a date, and it is September 13th, so it's going to show up on FX.
All right.
TV show, not movie.
Show. Yes.
Right? I know that we've mentioned it before, but it's Brian Vaughn's dystopian sort of novel where all the men and, like, was it X-chromosome
yep.
Animals?
Y-chromosome.
Y-chromosome? Yeah, duh. die across the world except for one guy,
and
mysteriously,
his
and his monkey. He is the protagonist, Yorick, the Y, if you will.
Yes.
And it has to sort of, like, try and figure out what his role is, what happened, and it's got
he's
road
also on a quest to find his girlfriend, fiancé, Beth.
His mom is a politician who, like, basically, like, everything everywhere kind of, like, falls into some disarray because... As they know in the first issue, so many leaders of the world leaders in a sort of a patriarchal world are men
yep.
that like things just kind of like collapses into disorder initially and takes a while to kind of like...
Do we know who's doing this? It's lost so many showrunners at this point.
It's interestingly, it lists Pia Guerra as one of the writers.
She is, of course, the artist of the comic.
And Michael Green, who I recognize that name. He's a guy who's been... he worked on Logan, Blade Runner 2049, Murder on the Orient Express, and Alien Covenant.
Well, 3 out of 4 is
yeah,
not bad.
That's okay.
Yeah.
I was going to say, by the way, for those who've seen the movie Children of Men, it has elements of, like, it's kind of close to that. There are some parallels.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Also, Diane Lane is playing York's mother.
Okay, I can see that.
Yep. Imogen Poots is playing There's two people listed as playing Hero Brown,
the sister.
And two people listed as playing Yorick. So I don't know if they're going to jump around in time a little bit.
Oh, I could see that. Maybe
show younger people.
I would imagine
so. Or if they've recast them. And I forgot, I wasn't sure about this. Lashana Lynch is still playing Agent 355.
Oh.
Which is cool, because that's one of the best characters.
Yeah,
and
it's a great character.
She played Maria Rambeau in Captain Marvel, and she's in the new James Bond, which also may or may not ever get released.
Right.
Well, now that Amazon owns it, it'll pop on Amazon. Next week.
It's going to cross over with the Lord of the Rings show.
I'll be curious to see how this works out.
It's a really good comic that at least has the potential to adapt well. We'll see if they can do it.
Yep. FX is also just announced that they are developing Welcome to Night Vale for a TV show.
Welcome to Night Vale.
It's Jennifer Hutcheson, who's an executive producer on Better Call Saul, is one of the other, so
that's a good start.
That's a good pedigree. Joseph Fink and Jeffrey Craner, the guys who created
the original writers,
executive producers. So it'll be interesting. I actually really like Welcome to Night Vale, and it says it's in a fictional southwestern desert town.
Yep.
And I've fallen off for listening to it just because it was so much.
Yeah, there's a lot of content.
But I can totally see a good version of Welcome to Night Vale as a TV show.
I can too, but there is the weird thing where it's essentially a radio show, and has always been a radio show to me, or a podcast, modern radio show. And I have in my head a sort of vision of what the town looks like, and I don't know what do they mention? There's no mountains around it because the people there also don't believe in mountains.
Right.
And I'm I kind of like that as something they just occasionally remind you of.
Yeah.
But if it's just sheer empty landscape, I don't know if it's going to, will it weird me out? I have a picture of it in my head.
The weird empty landscape is going to freak you out, but the glow cloud, that's not going
to. That's its normal brand of weird.
All hail the glow cloud.
I wonder if Cecil, so if, by the way, in the off chance that, I mean, this show, it's been a little bit and it's kind of fallen off some radars, but for people who haven't read it, or seen it, it's sort of like what used to be one of those community, do they call those?
Community, it's like an NPR, community radio station.
Community radio thing where they're talking about events in the town and little bits of town news and the weather and stuff like that in a town that's like a crazy X-Files town.
Yeah.
And it is all kind of done with dry tongue-in-cheek. Everybody is used to weirdness constantly.
I wonder if they incorporate the weather and have indie bands and stuff on it and something.
I think that'd be cool, actually. Be cool. I thought that was...
I wonder if it's going to circle around the radio station somehow. Or if it will just be about the town, because looking at this, they could easily do a thing where it's Eureka, or what's the town? Is it Eureka, the one that had the sheriff and all that stuff?
Yeah, that was on USA, yeah.
The weird, there's a couple of things like that. There was Erie, Indiana, I think. There's been a few
comparable.
Here's a weird city kind of thing.
Erie, Indiana for sure had some similar vibes.
Honestly, a sort of more supernatural tinge, Northern Exposure, There's definitely
I think Northern Exposure is a good comparison point, too.
There's definitely a show to be had here.
Yeah, I think also what you do is, you take... there is drama on the show. It is mostly dryly humorous, but, there's relationships, there's mysteries, there are people who, even in a town of strange things, that are worse than others.
There are story arcs. There's the corporation trying to take over for a little while. I mean...
Yeah.
There's Hiram the Dragon.
Yep. There's mayoral challenges.
Yep.
There's the man in the tan suit.
Right.
There's Cecil and Carlos.
Carlos, yeah.
Also, I wonder what Cecil's going to look like. Will it be what's his name from the radio show?
I don't know. I mean, there are.
Or will it be the way fans drew him?
There are fan versions of all these characters that have been drawn.
They'll probably do their own thing.
But we'll see. I'm actually kind of excited for it. What's interesting to me is the ideal person to run this in my mind is Brian Fuller.
Yeah.
Looking at Pushing Daisies and the stuff he did before he did Hannibal, I think Brian Fuller would be the guy to do this. But he's busy because he's going to be doing a Christine movie for Blumhouse.
Yes. Interesting. About 10 years ago, or maybe not quite 10 years, I watched Christine, the 80s version, for the first time. It came out in, 82, 83, somewhere in there. That's by John Carpenter. And I had always skipped past it because... there's a lot of bad Stephen King movies from the 80s.
Right. And also, it's about a haunted car, which sounds weird.
It's about a haunted car, which sounds weird. And nobody ever talked about it. When I actually saw it, I thought it was really quite good.
Okay.
That it was, deserved a better reputation than it's got. That said, it didn't feel like this is the definitive version. And if they could... do like a really badass new movie of it, I think I'd probably be down.
Well, I think one of the things Fuller does, I think it's the first movie he's directed, isn't it? He's mostly TV guy.
Yeah, mostly TV.
So Fuller, for whatever else he does, he is a very stylized guy. And I think to make something like Christine work, you need stylization.
You know, I'm not 100% sure on that, because at the heart of the book and even the previous movie is like an unusual friendship between some high schoolers. Mm-hmm. This is essentially a kind
of... this is a Stephen King book. Do they have an orgy?
There's not.
Okay.
But there's, kind of a nerdy kid and kind of a... I don't know. He's not even like quite a jock, but maybe a little bit of a jock, but like a nice guy jock. And they have an interesting friendship. And the car, when he gets is the nerdy kid, Randy, and it starts to like change who he is. And there's other like sort of subplots and stuff going on. There's also a scary bully in the tradition of what's his name from Stand By Me. Jack Bauer, who's the actor.
Kiefer Sutherland.
Kiefer Sutherland. Yeah, if you think about, like, it's not literally him, but it's one of those scary Stephen King guys.
Right.
Clearly knew like some switchblade wielding utter piece of shit when he was growing up in the
60s. Right.
Yeah. Anyway, it's good. I do recommend people read the book too. This sounds like it could work out.
King just hit some acid and just saw a car and was like, that car's definitely possessed.
Yeah, don't you feel its vibe, facts. Man?
it's radiating anger.
They announced a Marvel Multiverse RPG that's coming, which I think...
We saw a lot of interest in this when we posted it on the store's Facebook page.
But also some skepticism. People are like... Because I think the last RPG was not great.
Right.
It was by Weiss and Hickman's like company.
The 80s version is beloved.
It's beloved, yeah.
So, but...
But that Weiss and Hickman, that was like... What, at least 10 years ago?
10 or 15 years ago.
It was predicated on Civil War, so
wasn't that like 2008 or something?
Yeah, it was it's been a while.
So it's been a while since they've dipped their toes.
That's what I'm saying. People remember when a game doesn't do well.
It's true. Like, they do.
So because Dave says, the Marvel RPG in the '80s was so beloved and
people are still playing it.
I hope that they will do a little bit of that. It does say in here, use might, agility, resilience, vigilance, ego, and logic to win the day, which says to me that they are doing something similar to the old what they call phase rip system.
Right, that was like an acronym for and they had like a cool one chart to rule them all kind of thing that you could look at to figure out what you needed to roll. Yeah.
People will pick up the source book.
Yeah. So
certainly we are hoping it's good.
It's written and co-designed by Matt Forbeck, who does the Marvel Encyclopedia and a thing called Dungeons and Dragons Endless Quest. So that's a good sign.
Like
the Marvel Encyclopedia is pretty great. It is using the D616 system, which is kind of funny, except that they usually that D6, D20, I don't know what a D616 is. It's cute, but I'm like,
it's got to be like a D6 system, and they were just being cute, right?
I think probably so. Forbeck sounds excited. He says it's a dream come true. And it is going to be out in March, supposedly, 2022.
I was going to say we've passed it, if so.
So we got a little while. The playtest rulebook will include profiles for Spider-Man, Black Panther, Captain America, Thor, Captain Marvel, Miss Marvel, Wolverine, Storm, and many more. So,
we'll I want at least one weirdo to be to get stats for. Speed I want ball. Star Fox.
Dave, I don't think you're going to get Star Fox.
Death Fox.
Why?
Just put Sleepwalker in it. Come on, guys.
Sleepwalker's good. He'd also work.
Sure. Sleepwalker, Darkhawk, and...
And Star Fox.
And Star Fox and Night Thrasher. Okay, some casting news out of Marvel. Issa Rae has joined Spider-Verse 2 as Spider-Woman.
Yay!
Do you guys know Issa Rae?
No, off the top of my head.
Her show.
Yeah.
Why am I blanking on the name of that show?
Insecure,
yeah.
She's hilarious.
She was also in Lovebirds, right?
She'll be playing Jessica Drew?
Yes, and I have a feeling, because she is a black woman, that they're going to race flip Jessica Drew.
That's awesome.
And I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, I feel like that works pretty well for her.
Yeah.
Jessica Drew, for those who don't know, aka Spider-Woman, has one of the most convoluted origins. Yeah. It literally is like changed 2 or 3 times and has evolved everything from like the High Evolutionary to mysticism that goes back to King Arthur, like Morgan Le Fay stuff. And then she's also like a detective in San Francisco.
You will not be surprised to learn she's a Chris Claremont character.
He didn't do all of that stuff, though. I think he did the Arthurian stuff. I think they even might have said, like, hey, the High Evolutionary stuff isn't really taken off. I think they gave him an okay to kind of do a soft reboot.
Maybe so.
Like, I don't think he was, like, doing it to be convoluted or to try and, like, weasel out.
No, but
I think,
that is one of his, like, that's one of his things that he likes. He's King Arthur stuff.
Yeah, I think he essentially inherited a broken character.
So, yeah, it was created by Archie Goodwin, of all people.
That's Rory interesting.
Severin. Yeah, she's a spy.
Sometimes she's got a big shield ties.
She has gliding abilities, bioelectric energy, pheromone manipulation, venom blasts.
Yep.
She's all over the map.
Yep. But I like Spider-Woman. I've seen good stories with her. One of the earliest comics I got was a Spider-Woman, and it was pretty good.
Yeah.
She's in the Avengers Annual 8, which is one of the great annual comics of all time.
Oh, okay. So, in her first appearance, Spider-Woman was to be an actual spider evolved into a human, as imagined by Archie Goodwin. That's why High Evolutionary. Then her debut was... She was basically created as a character who established the trademark.
Oh, wow.
And then she was popular, so they brought in Marv Wolfman to present a different origin, which involved her being a part of Hydra.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yes.
And then she was a spy. And then he introduced Morgan Le Fay as her arch nemesis. And then Claremont brought in all the Camelot stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder what version they will go with. Like, is she going to be like a detective who finds out that she's a sleeper agent for Hydra?
No.
I think that'd be neat.
I want one of those 5-minute interstitials explaining their backstory and all of that included.
You know what's crazy? In the MCU, I would say they wouldn't do that, but in Spider-Verse, they might. They might do a thing of like, yeah, I was evolved from a spider, and then I did this, and then I did this.
Right, like
and
she's
then I
got
Morgan Le Fay,
and now I'm a detective in San Francisco, and I have a kid. I would love if they bring in the single mom thing that Dennis Hopeless created, because I love that run of the
and
character.
Porcupine. Or
yeah, who, her husband is the guy, the one time very weird villain Porcupine.
Yeah,
yeah.
All right, what else we got?
And then She-Hulk has cast Jamila Jamil from The Good Place as Titania, which is. Titania. Which is Absorbing Man's girlfriend, and she also
she's
like,
a
foe.
Yeah, she's a super strong woman, a obvious kind of opposite for She-Hulk.
I am excited about this casting.
I love her.
It's going to be very different than Titania in the comics.
In the comics, she's this kind of real brash, trash-talking chick. Kind of a blue-collar, take-no-bullshit chick. I don't know what this actress is like.
I'm wondering if they're going to make her a lawyer or something.
I think so.
Because it makes more... It seems
as
like...
sort of like
a rival lawyer
and
a rival strong woman.
Yeah. I think that's possible. Because Jamila Jamil does not seem like... She is not the blue-collar... Tough gal. Yeah.
They fight in the courtroom. They fight on the streets.
Yeah.
Is that what's going on?
But then she might get powers eventually. And
yeah.
I think that would be really cool.
Too.
Yeah, she could be representing a client that's like, you know, has Hydra ties and might have.
No, she's going to be representing a client, Crusher Creel.
I mean, I could see it.
We saw a couple teaser trailers. The like 30-second teaser for League of Super Pets.
Right, just a really barely. It seems like a proof of concept, but it's. A CG movie that's we think is getting a theatrical release.
Yeah, pretty sure in
2022. And that's DC's League of Super Pets, you know, that has like Crypto and Streaky and Comet, the super horse, and all that. All the weird pets that they've actually had, and then a lot that they didn't have back in the day.
The animation looks good.
It looks really good.
Dwayne Johnson is voicing Crypto.
They use the music from the original 78 Superman, you know, the famous John Williams theme. And Crypto flies by the viewer and gives him the wink.
Yep. Kevin Hart is voicing Ace.
Yeah.
Is it Kristen Wiig? Who did I see the name that popped up there that's probably voicing Streaky?
Oh, we don't know. There's Kristen Wiig, Keanu Reeves, and...
Yeah, Keanu Reeves is probably playing Bobo the Super Chimp. Let's be honest.
No, Topo the Octopus or bust.
Anyway, it's just a teaser. It doesn't tell us anything about it, but I'm kind of excited for it.
The animation looks good, and it's got a fun vibe to it, which is kind of what you want.
And then we got the trailer for He-Man and the Masters of the Universe Revelations, which is Kevin Smith's Netflix animated series that's starting in mid-July.
Yeah, it's a rethink of He-Man, but it looks to be, in many ways, quite close to it.
Oh, I wasn't going to say rethink. I think, like, love letter. I think he grew up on this and wants to basically make it as, you know, close to it as possible.
I thought it was going to be more like Invincible or Castlevania and, like, kind of a little, if not hyper-violent, at least somewhat violent. And, like, lots of, like, little bit pieces, like, Merman is his stoner buddy, Jason Mewes.
Yeah.
I know Jason Mewes does voice somebody in there. There probably will be at least something like that.
Yeah.
But it actually looked, yeah, like a really high-quality animation.
Straightforward, yeah.
And some fun music cues.
Yes, it uses the 80s kind of goofy pop song.
I Need a Hero,
yes.
Also, I did catch Orko in there, so they're not getting away with
it. He kind of looked a little more serious and like he was doing some big spell.
Yeah.
So I think they will lose the, I was just trying to help He-Man.
I think so, too, yeah.
Kind of stuff and have him be like, probably goofy, but also kind of a badass,
if I
had to guess.
I'm weirdly excited for this, and I have no fondness for this property at all, but it looks kind of fun.
I have fondness because I had all the toys, and they were kind of, they were just fun. You know,
it's weird. I had a lot of the toys, but even at the time, I think I was like I would kind of make fun of the cartoon while I watched it.
Yeah.
I liked parts of it, but I was also like, oh, they're reusing that animation.
Yes.
All He-Man ever does is throw that same boulder.
Yep.
And,
God, there's Cringer again.
And, oh, God, there's Cringer again. And yet, at the same time, I did have a fair number of the toys. They were pretty cool. I liked the weird monstrous muscle men.
Yeah.
And I need to quick go around the table and just ask what character or He-Man villain or hero are you most looking forward to seeing? Nick.
Mechanic.
Was that a toy you had?
Yeah, I did. I had a lot of them. I even had like the weird, was it Mossman?
Yeah. I had Stinkor, Skunk Man.
Stinkor was pretty cool. Stratos.
He looked neat to me. I wasn't quite fully aware of how much that the figure would literally give off his nasty stank vapors. Yeah. Randy, I know you are not a follower of, but you still have to pick someone.
I will pick Manny Faces because of his name.
It's a good one. He was a great figure.
He was.
He had an iconic look that looked like a hero, actually, even though he was a bad guy, yep. I think, right? He had a robot and a monster face and a... You know, like the robot he made?
You talking about Faker?
Is it Faker?
No, Faker was the blue skin.
No, he was
He-Man.
Like the see-through. There's a clear robotic guy.
Yeah, he's kind of neat looking.
Yeah, he had a neat look. I can't remember his name, though.
So my favorites of the toys I had tended to be the slightly oddball ones. I loved Clawful,
yep.
A lobster man who had like one big oversized lobster crunching hand.
I should remember this.
I liked Spidor, a very dark blue dude who had a backpack with a little grappling hook on it.
Yep.
Triclops, big into Triclops. I was happy to see him, and apparently Henry Rollins voices him, I have been told. Yeah,
amazing.
That's nuts, but I'm really liking
Kevin's
it.
Kevin's just going to bring in all of his friends.
Yeah,
I mean.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that those are I had three. Sorry, it was more than I wanted, but if I had to pick one, it's Triclops. Oh,
by the way,
coolest thing about Triclops, they had a thing with that. Manny Faces had three things. Yeah. But Triclops had a sword that would sheathe on his armor in the back, sort of like Conan's sword in like the in the Conan movies.
Yeah.
And it made me want for him to be a good guy because I was like, he has the coolest sword thing of all the characters. Anyway.
And it looks like what? Mark Hamill was voicing Skeletor.
Mark Hamill's Skeletor.
Yeah, we knew that was coming, and you just hear it briefly, but it sounds like he's going to have fun relishing the villainy.
Yeah. Last bit, Lord of the Rings, War of the Rohirrim anime movie announced. I don't know.
You have to say Rohirrim, Randy.
Whatever.
It's like an actual like anime production that's going to, you know, reveal sort of, you know, big lost action adventure military history.
This is for Netflix? Or no, this is for Amazon?
Amazon, yes. Okay. It's I thought they were doing just their big super expensive live action show. I'm less interested in some animated...
When you spend $540 million on a property, you're going to make more than just one thing.
I guess so. But, like, it doesn't interest me particularly at all.
Well, it doesn't interest you in this room. I think you are the best...
You who are watching Castlevania and other anime.
That was a very rare case. Very rare.
You're the biggest Lord of the Rings fan in this room, I believe, Dave. So,
probably.
Yeah.
I've seen other people who are excited about it, but like among the more dedicated bookish side, I think they're like, oh, Jesus. Ever since like Tolkien's son died and they kind of like the estate opened up what they're gonna do, I think people are like, oh, we're gonna see toys everywhere. They're gonna merchandise it in like a really obnoxious way. Not like those movies that haven't already been merchandised, by the way.
No. I mean,
but.
Really?
Did they do toys?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they did.
I can't remember.
I have a toy of Galadriel right over there.
Okay. I guess that kind of can't get too much crazier then. But I don't know, maybe when they do cheesy comics that are like weak comics,
yeah,
I don't
maybe,
know.
Maybe when they open the pop dispensaries have Uruk-hai, get you Uruk-hai.
Yes.
I bet that the host of that Lord of the Rings podcast you listened to a while back is going to watch the anime.
Probably so, yeah.
He seemed pretty open to the idea that Lord of the Rings can be whatever it wants.
Yeah, he's open to interpretations and like to use them as places to discuss the books. And this is probably going to be touching on like lesser known eras of the history where they can both like have a lot of leeway to interpret things. Like it'll just like a few big key events are known, and then they can build like internal dramas and things within that.
Yeah.
So it could work out. I'm just not interested remotely. I don't want no cartoon elves.
I get it. And again, you're the biggest cartoon elf person in this room too. So yeah. Okay, that's it for news. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back to talk about comics for the week. We are talking comics for the week of Wednesday, June 9th and June 16th, although I believe mostly what we're talking about is this week's comics.
Yeah, we're going to mostly just kind of breeze through last week's, but there's plenty to talk about this week, so we'll focus on it.
Yeah, just real quick, last week did bring us about Batman the Detective number 3, which continues to be a pretty good Tom Taylor series.
Oh, that's another one that I need. I missed it last week in the chaos. I need to read it.
Joker number 4, which we're all digging Joker.
Yep.
This week, I'm going to start off. We usually start with our number one stuff, but I'm going to start off with a tribute to what I believe is the best superhero comic right now, maybe the best comic right now, Nightwing number 81.
Randy, I'm going to have to stop you from being such a DC fanboy.
You just got to stop it. Don't make me acknowledge this
every time, Randy. Every time.
I hate it.
But listen. We were remarking it is a crazy turnaround at DC. It is kind of constantly boggling how good a lot of their books have gotten.
The thing is, everything is cyclical in comics, and I should have seen this coming. But I was like, it had been like 15 years since I was in love with DC books to this extent.
I do think that, you know, like, I think we are only speculating, but we do think that Dan DiDio going as editor in chief.
No, he was narrator-in-chief.
What was his
role?
He
was, like, publisher or something.
Oh, yeah. Whatever creative control he exerted, which included he didn't like Nightwing.
Yep.
We know that he was always pushing against it and wanting to, like, kill Nightwing off.
He loved Red Hood. Jason Todd was his Robin, he didn't like Dick Grayson or Tim Drake, who, by the way, both better Robins.
Yep.
Hell, Damian's better than Jason Todd.
Listen, like Jason Todd, but I don't like him as
Jason
Robin.
Todd is a fine Red
Jason
Hood.
Todd, his story, he's ended up building into a strong character.
Yeah.
But this week we were talking about the Nightwing has been really exceptional since he took over, and he just took over with like issue 78 or something. It's just
this is the fourth issue of his run.
It could have been a new number one, but they didn't do that, and it's actually, there's nothing that's completely, like, mind-blowing as far as, like, it didn't revamp everything hardcore. It's, like, he's just super well-written.
He brought back Bloodhaven.
Yep.
And he's using some of Dixon's characters.
Yep, there's a strong supporting cast, including Oracle in it as a...
Yeah, he's using Oracle, which that was a big decision of Rebirth that I think made it... Or not Rebirth, but Infinite Frontier. Mm-hmm. That was one of their big decisions was to... Basically, like, her implants were... she can walk, but if she uses it for Batgirl-type stuff, it could fry. It's basically like she's just go back to being behind the scenes, which, by the way, I'm all for. I loved her as Oracle.
Yeah, but as it is, I think she's behind the scenes, but, like, if somebody tried to jump her, I think she'd kick their ass.
It's true.
It's just that, like, she can't be doing that all the time.
But that's the thing. That's what she was able to do in her wheelchair. I feel like putting her... Bringing her back out of the wheelchair was a big decision that, unfortunately, you can't undo.
Yeah. We all loved the wheelchair bound Oracle as she existed.
Stick fighting
Oracle. Yeah.
She was a badass in the chair.
But,
and I feel like that kind of sucks because there aren't a lot of like wheelchair bound heroes who get to be badasses.
She was the best.
And I feel like that they really just undercut a lot of character.
But, now that said, to take it back to the positive streak, she is great in this comic.
The chemistry, and also Tim Drake as sort of Dick's younger brother, basically.
Yeah.
The three of them have great chemistry together.
Yeah, Tim Drake showed up in the last issue, and there's a little bit of internal monologue where Nightwing is like, there's some people out there that think he's the best of the Robins. He's like, I can see it. And he's like, real gracious about it. And I love when they kind of do that sort of stuff when they're like, you don't have to, like, pit these guys against each other. And also, Dick Grayson is not a guy who would do that. He is a the anti-Batman. He's like he sees the best in people, and he knows that Tim is a good guy, and he wouldn't hesitate to call it. He doesn't have that ego.
There's just so many little things about this book that Taylor injects that make it that much better.
The moment of our writing is really good. I don't want to spoil stuff.
No.
There's some big reveals.
Yep.
There's the moment-to-moment stuff is really good. He's got a dog. I really like his stuff with the dog. And there's a moment in here that feels like the Dark Knight movie. Like a moment in the Dark Knight movie that didn't work, that I actually think is cheesy and terrible, mm-hmm. that Tom Taylor does a version of it that works.
I also like him taking on a superhuman person, which he has done countless of times, but Taylor goes out of his way to show how he can handle that.
Yeah, he's like, this guy's got powers, but doesn't have any training.
Yeah.
Right, he's a guy who, like, he's like, he was doing the shortcut to being a supervillain.
And not to undercut, but Bruno Redondo's artwork is...
Man, Redondo's art is so good.
He's on that level of Chris Samnee and, man, who am I blanking on? Who worked with Mark Waid on Daredevil? It was Paulo Rivera.
Yeah.
He is in that ballpark.
I agree. His storytelling is great.
Basically, wherever, like, I don't want him to leave this book, but wherever he goes, I'm going to be kind of watching him now.
Well, and
he should stay on this book.
He did Suicide Squad with Taylor.
Okay,
really good there. But
they clearly have a good working relationship.
This is another level. Like he makes Nightwing the acrobatic stuff shows up in a way that it hasn't in a lot.
Can we stay in the Taylorverse for just a second and talk about the hardcover that gets released?
Yes, Deceased at Hope's End.
This is something I didn't even remember existed.
Yeah, last week when I was importing stuff, I was like, holy crap, there's a Deceased hardcover that I haven't read.
Oh, I knew this was coming, and I've been excited for it. So these were the digital first ones he did.
Right, so there have been two main Deceased miniseries, one side miniseries about the villains. We've loved all of them.
There's been three Deceased miniseries. There's three hardcovers.
Well, what I was saying was like two main ones, I guess,
and one side villain.
Yeah, total of three.
And then this one takes place between 1 and 2.
Okay.
And it's 15 issues long. I mean, they're digital issues.
It's like a little bit...
they're vignettes in a lot of ways, but longer vignettes.
The vignettes do kind of to tell one big story.
Yes.
He did those sort of smaller, shorter chapters, like 8 or 10 pages or whatever. Each issue of Injustice was made up of two of those because it was digital first as well.
Yep.
Like, he knows that format.
He knows how to work in that format, and it works well here. He also... in addition to using the legacy superheroes of Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman that he uses a lot in Dead Planet, this is sort of the transition for them.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, like, it uses Black Adam, and so reveals what happened to him and some other heroes and villains. He uses Wink and the Eerie from his Suicide Squad run,
which I thought was really cool. Well. Pied Piper,
yeah, of all people,
man, the old Flash villain. That guy's gotten a little bit of. He's had some decent moments as
Taylor has a handle on the DC characters in a way that feels like Justice League Unlimited. It feels like the sort of pinnacle of the characters that you want.
Yes, I agree.
And I want him to stay with Nightwing. I want him to do a Green Arrow book desperately because I feel like
Green Arrow would be the best.
Yeah.
But I want him on Justice League because I feel like he could tell an amazing story about those characters.
Yeah.
And he's a writer that can handle a team.
I have this feeling that, and like he dabbled with it a little bit when he did the Justice League Power Rangers, but I have a feeling that he maybe in his head is like, I'm not quite sure I'm ready for the Justice League yet.
Yeah.
Maybe he's waiting for some point, and then he's like, when I've got some really good stories that I've kind of thought up, then I'll take over or whatever.
It also may be that he doesn't want to write the A-listers in general. Injustice and Deceased are both A-list, but they're the A-listers and everything, but it's off to the side.
It's true.
And his focus is always on, like, Green Arrow, Harley Quinn. He does other side characters. So it may be that it's like, he's like, I don't want to write those guys. He has made jokes about, he's like, Batman? Yeah, he's one of Nightwing's best sidekicks. So I think there may be something to that. Are they like, you know what? The other characters are this... There's a less of a, I have to fit in this iconic mold, I can do more work with.
Right.
His story's also reached that balance of, yes, it's darkness, but there is a ray of hope that just shines through everything.
There's light and idealism and humor.
It's not oppressive.
Yeah.
And, you know, and just in case, I think we've probably, anybody listening to this probably knows what Deceased is, but it is like DC's zombie story with an infectious anti-life equation, which was a really cool idea.
And if you haven't read it, pick up the first trade.
Yeah, like, we were a little skeptical when it first showed up. Not so much because it was Tom Taylor doing it, but, like, none of us were like, oh, I sure wish DC had their own zombie book.
Yeah.
And then it turned out to be super good. Yeah. So, like, I really recommend it to just about anybody who, like, has any fondness for DC stuff.
Yeah, for sure. This week also sees the return of Milestone,
mm-hmm.
The first of one of three miniseries.
I don't know if people know what that Milestone was, the you know, people of color run diverse comic of the 90s.
I mean, when we talked about the
yeah, that's true. That's true. And
this
yeah.
is the first of the three miniseries.
Ongoing. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. But full comic.
This is Static season one. So this is Virgil Hawkins, who is a teenager who gets electricity powers. In his original incarnation, he was very much a Spider-Man type.
Yeah. He's kind of a nerdy kid.
And in here, they're doing sort of a... he is a nerdy kid, but his dad, like, taught him martial arts, and he's, like... It's a little more superhero-y. It's not as quite Steve Venture.
It feels very Flash TV show.
Yes.
Where there's a supporting cast. The family members are definitely very important. Like, the relationship with his sister... And he's got friends at school that are, like, super close. I actually thought it was a good format for it. I do like the original Static and him, you know, being more akin to Peter Parker, like,
people know, sometimes, by the way, know Static from animation, of course.
Right. Yeah, of course. TV
show, his own cartoon showed up on Justice League Unlimited, right, and some other stuff.
Yeah. But I thought Villarreal had a good handle on it. I thought it was a good first issue.
It is a good first issue.
I also like... I'm still getting used to the new style of it, but like Chris Cross's artwork does look cool.
Yeah.
I mean, to some degree, like one of the things that Milestone did was like not all black characters had when they did it in the 90s, they didn't all have the exact same skin tone.
Yeah.
That was a point of pride that they had a color process that was not like the kind of cheesy CG colors, had a little bit more of a like sort of realistic look, but had a wide scope. And the same way you will see lots of different hairstyles from a creator who's black who's, like, researched these that tends to just not show up so much with the whitey-white artists that have tended to dominate superhero comics.
Right.
So it's that is also nice to see. But, what else? Coming up, by they'll have Icon and Rocket
and Hardware.
Hardware.
We've got Venom number 200, the much-anticipated Venom 35, actually, but... It's their
200 total issue of issues of Venom.
But it's Donny Cates' last.
It's the big finale of Donny Cates' run. And it's actually really good. It's a kind of emotional epilogue to the story of him and his son and the symbiote. And he did an interesting thing where he created this big collective and this god, Null. And Eddie gets in touch with that. But his symbiote, the Venom symbiote, has been cut off from all of that. So it's its own thing, and it's like it acts as basically a pet and a guardian for his son. But there's a bit here where he talks to Spider-Man, he talks to the Avengers. It is definitely they've definitely done a different thing with him.
It looks like it. I have not read this yet, but hearing y'all describe it, it sounds like it was like very much a big sort of like would this almost function as if it were the last Venom story?
Yes. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
It feels like a. It's the finale of the character for a lot of ways.
Well, we know that's not happening.
But then there's a couple backup stories. One is Flash Thompson, who's now back alive, being anti-Venom. And they're dealing with sort of like what it's like for him to be in this world that had an invasion of symbiotes and people are now skeptical of them. And then there's another backup that has...
I think I would have been skeptical of the symbiotes even before the invasion.
Then there's another son with his son Dylan that shows him in high school... That sort of sets up the new status quo that Al Ewing is going to be doing, and I'm into it. I liked it.
Randy, if I had told you 10 years ago that you'd be pretty into a Venom comic,
it's weird.
Yeah,
but I feel.
But that is a testament to what can be done with these kind of characters.
We were talking off mic, and we were saying that I mean, Donny Cates is sort of like. Radically changed Eddie Brock in kind of a way that...
But it felt pretty organic, don't you think?
Oh, it did, but it's like, at the end of this, like, the toys are different. Like, as opposed to certain ones
are just...
He
normally does not do that.
He normally puts the toys back in the box. Like, Guardians of the Galaxy, he put the toys back in the box.
Yeah. This one, Venom's changed.
Yeah.
And become something different and something bigger.
Yeah.
And I kind of like it. I feel like Venom was such a small character...
Yeah.
And just kind of...
You're saying he can grow giant now?
He can grow giant now.
That said, his new Venom, the status quo he sets up, is not unlike a basic Lethal Protector.
No, it's
you've
not.
You've got an angry host for a symbiote.
Yeah. No, it is, but it's also, there's more, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, he definitely added to things, and I think he's doing that with the store run, too. So I'll be curious to see what Ewing does, because Ewing's been doing some interesting changing stuff with Immortal Hulk.
Yep.
And I think that it's going to be interesting to see his Venom. So there's a new book from Image. I'm trying to think, is it Skybound? No, it is just an Image book. It is produced by Greg Rucka,
yep.
In that he's like a... It was like his idea, or he helped create it or something. He's nowhere in the credits here, by the way. It's Greg Rucka Presents.
Yeah, but like I read some interviews, and it seemed like, well, the writers actually did seem like they were talking about the concepts like it was pretty much pretty key to them.
Yep.
But it is, in short, this book is called Compass.
Compass, the Cauldron of Eternal Life. It's written by Robert McKenzie and David Walker. David Walker co-created Naomi.
Oh yeah. It's
art,
kind of
artist by Justin Greenwood, who is his artist on the show that I like with Kobe Smulders. What's the name of the show?
Oh, Stumptown.
Stumptown. This is the original artist from Stumptown, which
okay.
I had noticed when I was reading it. Actually, that it looks familiar.
But the short version of it is, it's like a pulp adventure book set in like the like an Arabic sort of like their Renaissance.
Yeah.
Meant to kind of. Somewhat throw away some of the older throw off the shackles of kind of and be a little bit more progressive with pulp.
I mean, the opening is essentially a Raiders riff.
It is like a tomb. Tomb infiltration.
I was gonna say, it's like a Middle Eastern Tomb Raider, basically.
And they even set up a counterpart for her that is like a rival, her Belloc,
yeah.
And then there's just some neat concepts in here, like mixing. You know, some fun stuff, and there's, like, the con, like, the evil person in this, the bad guy. There's just some interesting twists and turns. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I only had time to read the opening real quick, so I haven't read the whole thing, but I'm looking forward to checking it out.
Yeah.
Middle Eastern medieval pulp adventure sounds fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Dave, I think you got a chance to read The Seven Swords from Aftershock.
Yeah, I like, they weren't, I wasn't quite clear on what the concept was until I was making the sign for it, and I looked it up, and I realized this is essentially a, like, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen type thing of, like, the League of Extraordinary Swashbucklers.
The lead is essentially D'Artagnan.
It's D'Artagnan from the Musketeers. From the Musketeers. There's also, like, Captain Blood, who I guess started as a book thing, but I remember being, like, an old Errol Flynn pirate movie.
Yep.
But there's Captain Blood, there's Don Juan.
Yep.
And Cyrano.
Cyrano de Bergerac. Yeah. Who's a great swordsman
but
as well.
The D'Artagnan is our character in this one. We glimpse the others, but...
He's our lead, and he's older now a little bit.
He's
not,
older.
Not old.
No, but he's still sort of out for blood. The Musketeers are all gone, and he is in search of Cardinal Richelieu.
Yeah, who I believe is, like, doing, like, black magic type stuff. He's like, it's like kind of a little
sort of
larger...
relics of great power. I think in concept, this was such a fun idea.
Yeah, so D'Artagnan puts together a team, and it's not just musketeers, it's all the best swordsmen of the
exactly.
That's pretty fun. Yeah. Boom has a new book called Save Yourself. Nick, did you read this one?
I did. I really enjoyed it. It's lighthearted. It's sort of the Sailor Moon-esque, but sort of flips that as they are maybe not the good people that you think they are.
Hmm.
And a young woman sort of runs afoul of them, and... the people that they're hunting may or may not be bad guys, and it's just a fun idea. I could see that the art is really stunning. I did not recognize the artist's name, but in concept it was great, and I think could be a lot of fun for a lot of people.
There's another chapter of the Infinite Destinies. This is a Captain America annual. Jerry Duggan writing it. Basically, they're showing all these characters who, I guess, in Infinite... What was the last story that was... Infinity Wars.
Yeah.
I guess Adam Warlock used the Soul Stone to bond a living soul to each stone. So they basically, instead of being Infinity Stones, they're Infinity people.
Yeah.
So it's like a Star from Captain Marvel. And this one, they're dealing with the teleporter, who's... I forget his name. But... basically, Captain America and Black Widow are on the trail of this teleporter, trying to figure out if he's a black hat or if he's just like a wrong screw up in the wrong place at the wrong time. Apparently, he stuck up a jewelry store in Alabama and killed the husband and wife who owned the store, and then was in jail, and then he got the powers. which are like the time stone. So it's like he can, it looks like teleportation, but basically he's freezing time. And yeah, Captain Black went on his trail. It's an interesting story. It's an interesting standalone. This is planet-sized X-Men week, so we are at the midpoint of the X-Men gala, I believe.
It's not just giant-sized X-Men, it's planet-sized X-Men.
And there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
Yep.
This is a big twist in the X-Core, or the X-Men stories. So, yeah, if you've been reading along with the gala, or if you're curious to see what is going on with X-Men...
This is probably going to affect the state of things for the X-Men, like, for at least the next year. It's going it's probably the keynote, the keystone or whatever of sort of, like, the future of the X-Men.
It's also drawn by Pepe Larraz, who did House of X and Powers of Ten. I forget which one he did, but one of them.
Jupiter's Legacy Requiem comes out just in time for season two of the series to be announced. It's not happening. But if you watch Jupiter's Legacy and you're like, oh, I kind of want more of these characters, good news. There's one of these characters by its creator, Mark Miller, along with Tommy Lee Edwards, who always has really, really nice art.
Or for the many... we actually have a fair number of people who've just been following it since it started coming out in comics.
Yeah, well, this is one of those rare cases where, like, the show is basically... It's like the show becomes the trailer for the comic.
Right.
Like, the show sets up a lot of stuff, but the answers are never going to be in the show. They're going to be in the comics, and there's four volumes of Jupiter's Legacy, and now there will be a fifth, whereas there was just the one season of the TV show. So if you are jonesing for more of the sort of story of the younger heroes who make up the Jupiter's Legacy, that is more in here. And I will say the art on this is fantastic. It's really pretty. But yeah, if you like generational superheroes... and sort of more a little bit more real world superheroes, this would definitely be worth a look. DC has a new Supergirl book, Supergirl Woman of Tomorrow, by Tom King and Bilquis Evely, I think is the name.
Really, really a stunning artwork.
Yeah,
that reminded me of the art. He has a certain speed on his artists that he works with, and they tend to be detailed but also kind of grounded. So if you think about, like, the kind of art that you saw on Adam Strange or Vision or well, not Vision, but Mr. Miracle, who's that artist he usually works with, Nick?
Oh my God, why am I blanking on that artist's name?
Oh, that's okay.
Mitch Gerrits.
Yeah, Mitch Gerrits, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it has some of that qualities. But yeah, it's a sort of an off-world adventure, off-Earth adventure with Supergirl on this planet that has kind of a alien feudal state going on, and I think Tom King fans will probably dig this one.
Yeah. It's an 8-issue miniseries. Berserker number 3 comes out this week, so we are at the three-fourths of the way through the Keanu Reeves book. This has been much anticipated, and again, always nice art.
I think it's a fun story too.
Yeah. I think as far as, like, is there anything else that's, like, notably first issue? Yeah, I think that's all the big things.
Yeah.
There's issues of a few new things. Images, a bunch of stuff out this week. The Time Before Time number 2, which we all like, number 1. Radiant Black number 5, which is one of my favorite books right now. And Chip Zdarsky, Stillwater, I guess, another issue. And there's also another issue of Marvel's Alien, the penultimate issue of that. Another issue of The War of the Bounty Hunters. And Demon Days Mariko, which is Peach Momoko's sort of Japanese mythology thing. This one is Wolverine's girlfriend is the lead character, and I believe maybe a Black Widow analog is in it too. Anyway, very pretty art from Peach Momoko, sort of Japanese fables by way of Marvel. Some fun stuff. That is it for comics. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about Loki and In the Heights and some other movies and stuff. Okay, so I don't know if you guys know this, but movie theaters are back.
Yeah.
And also, there's still stuff on... Nick, you still have not set foot in a movie theater?
I have not.
So, but Dave and I both went out, and, I mean, Dave, I think you've seen... Have you seen other stuff in the movie theaters already?
I've seen Quiet Place,
okay, yeah. Conjuring 3, and now In the Heights.
So you've definitely... In the Heights was the first thing I saw in the theater besides...
I am a daring risk taker.
Besides seeing The Gentleman at a friend's private birthday party, which you also saw.
I saw that, and then I was at two other separate renting of whole theaters over the course of the pandemic.
So we went back to the Alamo Draft House to go see In the Heights.
Yep.
And I was kind of shocked when they played the little thanks for coming back to the movie stuff.
Yeah.
It was very moving. You're talking about
the one that the Alamo did?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the one I was telling you where they did it right.
Yeah, but also like Lin-Manuel Miranda and who else? John Chu, the director.
Right.
They did a little pre-credits of it. Thanks for coming out to this. We know what a big deal it is.
Yeah, just a little like minute-long sort of thing of sort of thanks for having some faith in the movies.
It was a thing where it's like kind of like when I first did my first game night back. I didn't realize how much I'd missed it.
Yeah.
Because I'd gotten used to it. It'd been a year and a half.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I was like, oh wait, I used to love this.
Yeah.
And it was like, yeah, oh, I mean, much as I enjoy sitting and watching stuff in my house, like, I love they're putting everything on HBO Max, I'm super glad I saw this in the theater.
Yeah, I am too. It's funny, I saw that it had, like, a bit of a weak opening as far as box office.
Yeah.
And I was looking at the comments, like, on KVU or something, commenting about it, and somebody was like, well, it makes sense. It's like, you know, people would flock to, you know, like, Quiet Place makes sense that it did better because it's, you know, such a big screen experience. And I'm like, a big musical with crazy big set pieces and like really great colorful visuals is also a big spectacle.
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
But you might prefer one or the other, sure.
But I think we have been conditioned that action movies and blockbusters are the ones you see on the big screen.
Yeah, musical, but that's a horror movie.
But Quiet Place really isn't.
But it is because of the sound and the monsters.
Because you have to be
like
a weird
that.
Shushy person in the theater.
And also, musicals, while they. There have been some.
Right,
we
are not used to them in general.
Comparatively to, like, 1950s Hollywood, where they were churning them out.
Yep.
And this is a love letter to that in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. John M. Chu, who directed Crazy Rich Asians, it makes sense he's the same guy who directed this, because he's got the same level of spectacle.
Well, and he also did the Step Up.
Did he?
Yeah, he did one of those.
And
he did, I think, Josie and the Pussycats, if I'm not mistaken.
So
he understands the spectacle of a number, basically the music.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda's musical he did before Hamilton.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't realized
it
that
went
this was
all the way back to, like, what did I looked it up the other day, it was like 2003 or something like that?
Yeah.
It's about Washington Heights, it's about a neighborhood that's sort of being gentrified.
Yep.
Right, but it's a big sort of Latinx neighborhood.
Yeah.
With lots of
Puerto Rican,
like, next generation immigrants from Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of a hopes and dreams of a broadcast, but zeroing in on one guy, Usnavi, whose name has a very fun explanation that I kind of don't want to give away. But he's telling a story to some kids, and the story flashes back to, you know, most of the movie that takes place in and around this neighborhood. And he has a big dream, though, of he runs a bodega.
Yeah.
That's, you know, like, he kind of runs it with some pride, but it's his, like, heart is wanting to return to
Dominican Republic.
And that's, like, his big dream, but it's, like,
he's been to since he was, like, five, I think.
But his father owned, like, a
bar,
there that he wants to basically
renovate because it got wiped out by a hurricane.
And
he's been trying to get the money to float the, like, a loan or whatever and make it happen again. And there's any number of other stories that kind of start intersecting with his.
Yeah, well, there's, like, his ex-girlfriend who moved away to go to school, right? No, that's
a different character.
That's the Corey Hawkins.
He has
She's a fashion designer. She wants to be a fashion designer.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he has a buddy played by Corey Hawkins who works at, the cab stand.
Yep.
Owned by Jimmy Smits.
Yep.
Who is his daughter
is the one that was at
is the one who went to, like, Stanford.
Stanford and dropped out because
she came back and was very disillusioned at some of the stuff she saw.
Right. And it's about sort of the balance between staying home in your sort of safe place where you have a community and, like, going out in the world, whether one is better than the other. And
it's also a bit about
comes to their own thing.
About, like, one's culture and if you're giving up something when you try and, like, blend in at, like, at a university. In this case, that's pretty white bread.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There's, like, a ton of big themes going on, but, like, really, you know, these are not explained in any sort of done in some sort of dry way.
No.
They're done through these really amazing musical numbers that, like Hamilton, incorporate both some traditional musical style stuff, but a lot of hip hop, and in this case, a lot of, like Latino musics of the styles of the neighborhood filter in and around through the music or through the songs.
There were some pretty show-stopping numbers in
here. The thing at the pool is fantastic.
Yeah, the was it nine? What is the name? Is it like the 900 days or
yeah, whatever it is.
600 days, I think, is what it is.
But that's really good. The bit at the end with Corey Hawkins and his girl doing the homage to like the dancing on the ceiling kind of thing.
Yep, was really great. It has a great opening number, of course, but there's like numbers that are done in like a gossipy salon.
Yes, oh, that's a great one.
It's super fun. There is a really like I really love the one in the end that was like the sort of the alleyway of everybody during the there's a heat wave hitting and like a power outage. Yeah, the carnival one was super good.
Apparently, they dropped like 3 or 4 songs out of this. Which
did you know that Nick?
From
the Broadway.
I've heard from people who said like that. Yeah, they dropped my favorite. Somebody said on my page they were like, they dropped my favorite song and they dropped my wife's favorite song and I still love this movie.
Yeah, it's 96,000. That's what. The,
oh, 96,000. Okay.
Yeah.
But I mean that's right because
it's the lottery thing. Yeah.
They do a lot of good setup that then pays off, and they're so good at like the sleight of hand that like I forgot about things that have been set up, like the lottery ticket and the blackout, which they tell us every day. They're like 3 days till the blackout, and I still was surprised when it happened.
Yeah,
the Carnival de Barrio.
That was so good.
Their character, by the way, their actors in here, like Corey Hawkins is great.
Mm-hmm.
Their lead,
who's
is
the lead?
First,
he was
the
great.
Lead was in Hamilton. He played his son and John Lawrence.
Yep. This is the role that's tricky to pull off.
Anthony Ramos.
Anthony Ramos, yeah.
Anthony Ramos has to like tie it all together.
Yep.
He's who's the kid who's like in his
his the dreamer his kid that's the, yeah
yeah
he's really good too.
Yeah. So like there's some just like stuff that immediately early on he's like kind of trying to work up the nerve to ask out this this girl, and there's just some great banter and like very universal situations. Like if you're like, oh, this isn't my culture, I'm gonna feel out of place in this movie. Like you're not gonna feel out of place.
No.
And also like that opening sequence where he's like hemming and hawing about asking her out, and this kid who works for him basically just does it for him.
Yeah.
And like he's just like about to die of shame until it sort of works.
Yeah.
And it's like really very relatable and super funny.
Both the female leads are really good. The
Abuela?
The beauty shop people, the Abuela is really good and she gets a great like
her number.
Oh my god.
Her number is amazing.
And then they've got Rosa from Brooklyn Nine-Nine is in this.
Yeah.
And Daya
Stephanie Beatrice
from Orange is the New Black.
And Dasha Polanco.
Both of them were great in like sort of smaller roles. I didn't know Stephanie Beatrice could sing.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Apparently she really can, because she carries her numbers.
But Jimmy Smits is really good.
I didn't know Corey Hawkins could sing. I mean, it makes sense, because he was in Restraint of Compton.
Oh, right.
But he's really good here.
He is.
It was fantastic. This is my second favorite movie I've seen this year, right behind Mitchell's vs. the Machines.
Yeah.
As far as just, like, my overall, like, how happy I was and sort of like what a ride it was.
Yeah.
It's my favorite of the year. I might have seen a movie I liked better, but like it just like felt good to see it.
Yeah.
It is one of those things that's like it's both emotional at times. It's uplifting at times.
Mm-hmm.
It is quite the ride to watch and it's also a spectacle of sorts.
Yeah.
So you're going to get a lot out of it. I do recommend the big screen version if you can make it happen.
And apparently with the low totals coming in, it may go out fast.
Yeah.
I watched it on HBO Max. However, I did watch it on a giant screen and utilized
I know you've got fancy new technology.
I have fancy new speakers. I ponied up and bought an entire Sonos sound system. So
Do you have a projector and stuff set up?
No, I have just a giant Sony screen, but I listened to this with sounds really bad, but Dolby Atmos sound.
Oh, I see.
So it is really, really nice.
So Nick, let me you just moved.
I did.
You're living amongst boxes, but you got the home theater set up.
Heck yes.
I mean, I get the priorities. That's where I'd be as well.
A friend of mine on Facebook just moved. It's literally the first thing he did as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I had all this technology sitting around in boxes, and I'm like, I need to get them out. I need to hear
everything else in here is expendable.
Yeah.
Honestly, my wife got my media room, like all the things bought.
Yeah.
Like that was, she was like, "You're getting that first." So
yeah.
She
awesome.
Agreed. Yeah.
But yeah, this is great. It's on HBO Max, but I do recommend seeing it in the theater if you can. Also, Lin-Manuel Miranda is in it.
He is.
He plays a guy who's slinging flavored ice.
Yeah.
Yep.
and has a rival with the Mr. Softy ice cream guy.
Yep, this is hilarious.
It's a great little bit.
This is one of those kind of movies that has, like, I can see why it was, like, a hit right out of the gates, because there's kind of something for everybody.
Yeah.
It is a great family movie and all of that stuff, too, so.
Also, Dave and Nick have not seen it yet. I went and made a point of watching it last night because I thought we were going to talk about it. There is a post-credit sequence. It is worth watching, so.
Yeah, I'm hyped to see it.
All right, I finally, I do not do the Disney $30 bonus thing usually, so I had to wait for it, but Raya and the Last Dragon just dropped.
Yep.
And I finally watched that, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a great movie. I honestly think that might be one of my favorite movies of the year.
It's up there. It's right underneath In the Heights for me.
It's a good story. Mm-hmm. It's got great characters. The world building is amazing.
What is the setting?
So it is a sort of a
fantasy Asian.
No, it's different Asian cultures. Yeah. There are five. So basically, there are these dragons.
Yep.
They imprison this sort of dark field. There's this dark force that would turn people to stone.
Okay.
And the dragons made a sacrifice to imprison them, and then the people left. Created nations based on the part of this giant dragon. So these people, the main ones, live in the heart. Is that right?
I believe so. They're seen as sort of the rich, affluent ones.
And the other ones, they guard the last dragon's like soul gem, basically. Okay. That is what keeps these forces at bay. And the father of Raya is an idealist, and he like invites all the people from the fist or whatever the tail, the
other families. And of course,
the other parts of the nation. So they all come together as this big like peace process to try and become the one nation again.
Yep.
And they all have their own machinations. And basically, the stone gets broken, and the force gets unleashed, as does the last dragon, voiced by Awkwafina.
Yep.
And Raya has to take this last dragon on like basically a road trip across these nations to try and rebuild the gem and re put these things back in the box.
I love her little roly poly animal.
Her roly poly animal is great. It's a good little sidekick.
Does that mean it's some kind of mythical creature type thing?
No, it's like a giant roly poly that she rides around.
Oh, like, it's literally like one of those.
I think like the animals of Avatar. There's actually a lot in common with Avatar this movie, and it's better for it. Amazing.
So basically, they go through these different nations. They wind up recruiting people from different nations.
Right.
They recruit this this one of my favorites is the baby that's a con, running a con.
Yep.
Along with two monkeys.
Yep.
And a kid who's like a chef who has a boat.
Yep.
They recruit all these people from the different parts as she's trying to find. She's dealing with her rival from when she was a kid, who she thought was going to be a friend, but who betrayed her and got the... Yeah. And she's sort of the villain of the piece, but also sympathetic.
I believe so.
Yeah. Anyway, it's really good. It's
the voice
got
cast
fantastic animation.
Too.
The voice cast is great. Like, it's... I enjoyed it quite a bit. I did not love it as much as Missiles vs. the Machines, as far as we're talking about animated movies, but it's up there. It's really, really good.
Yeah, the voices are like Kelly Marie Tran and Gemma Chan and Sandra Oh.
Yeah.
Alan Tudyk does Tuk Tuk.
Alan Tudyk plays Tuk Tuk, does Tuk Tuk, which Tuk Tuk is the name of like those little taxis in like Thailand and that kind of thing. And so it's kind of funny that's her transport.
And Benedict Wong plays the big tough guy.
Oh yeah, and he's great. Yep. Yeah,
yeah. Anyway, it's a really good one.
Super fun. Highly recommend it. It's on Disney Plus now. If you have the $30 to spare, you can watch Cruella right now. And Nick, I know you did that.
I did, mainly because I like Emma Stone a lot.
Was this as bonkers as it seems?
So it's a movie that shouldn't work. Because, honestly, a prequel to 101 Dalmatians and a...
a woman who skins puppies.
An origin story for a woman who skins puppies. How can you make that character likable?
Well, casting Emma Stone's a good first step.
Yeah, Emma Stone... is a good first step, and putting her against Emma Thompson, who is doing a Meryl Streep's Devil Wears Prada impression.
The writer from Devil Wears Prada, so yeah.
But it's just a blast. It's very kind of fun and crazy.
It's 60s Paris, right? Isn't it like fashion
it's 60s
industry?
Paris, utilizing some like punk music and rock music, and there's giant like. She creates this persona of Cruella de Vil as sort of a rival for Emma Thompson's.
Okay.
I think she's called the Duchess or something. Basically,
I think the Duchess is right.
Yeah, she is like the quintessential designer of the city and controls so much and has so much power. And she does kind of these like dumps of like new fashion and like stunts to Upstager, and there's just some great humor. Emma Stone does an amazing job. The costumes are fantastic.
So they find a way to, you know, it's clearly that this is a big reimagining, which I know, despite all the jokes, I knew they were not going to make this like a direct link into 101 right. Dalmatians. Oh. It was going to be more like...
Oh, there are.
Are there?
Yeah, there are definitely...
Does she skin puppies?
She does not skin puppies. There is a...
That's a character-defining thing.
There is a joke that she... Emma Thompson has two very ferocious Dalmatians. It's actually true to form because I know Dalmatians are pretty ferocious. Yeah. And she kidnaps them at some point, and she jokes about skinning them and makes people believe that she skinned them.
See, that's what I figured they were going to do. But in the sense that, like, that is what the character does, so that's, like, not the same character from 101 Dalmatians. It's a reimagined version.
Right.
Yeah.
Because also that was that the cartoon has no fashion side to anything. Like, they did a pretty heavy overhaul, kind of like they did with Jungle Book or something like that.
It feels kind of close, though, and there are, like, direct links to the... to the animation.
But it can't.
Well, I watched the pitch meeting for it.
Uh-huh.
And it's hilarious, and it looks really pretty. Like, I kind of want to see it just based on that.
Yeah, it's very pretty. I actually thought the story was fun, and the performances are good. The underlings, they're basically the two kind of slightly doofy...
The henchmen.
Henchmen.
That are her henchmen in the movie, right?
Yeah, they are, but there's more to it than that. They actually, like, find her as an orphan and kind of take her in. But the actors who play them are hilarious. One of the guys...
Now, what's weird is Cruella in 101 Dalmatians is an old woman, and if these guys adopted her, they should be, like, super ancient.
But no, they were kids. They're kids on the run. Oh, they're kids. Orphans okay. themselves.
Okay. All right, okay.
And, yeah. It's a movie that shouldn't work, but does.
That's what I keep hearing. When it comes to the free Disney Plus, a free quote-unquote, I will watch it.
I think I've bought every stupid $30 Disney movie that's
You're
come out.
You're the mark, Nick.
I am the mark. No, as we've learned, I press play.
You press play. Nick likes
to
press play.
I'm going to press play for $30 to watch Black Widow at home.
You're not going to see it at the theater, Nick?
No, I think I'm not. On that one, I...
You're not going to see it with the fellas?
You can come over to my house.
Nope.
I mean, we're going to go to the theater to see Fast 9 in a couple of weeks.
That's true. I mean, I'm not afraid, but...
All right. Well, we'll see. And then, also, movie at home, I think you guys watched Conjuring 3. What is it called? Yeah. The Devil Within?
The Devil Made Me Do It.
The Devil Made Me Do It.
Right. It's loosely kind of... I mean, it's based on a... Like all of them, loosely based on one of the cases of the Warrens, the... Yeah. Real life, again, in quotes, husband and wife, investigators and investigated Amityville and the what's the doll, Annabelle, and all that stuff. All of which is, like, turned into an extremely heightened version for the movies in which, A, they're not charlatans, B, all the monsters are real, C, they're actually quite likable.
Charismatically played by Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga.
Yep.
Yeah.
I was looking at Patrick Wilson in this, and he actually, he has during a very intense exorcism that begins the movie, he has a heart attack.
Yep.
And he has to deal with it for the rest of the movie, and it's kind of interesting because it sidelines him as an action kind of guy. He kind of can't protect his wife. He can't be out there up front. He can't chase people and stuff like that when he needs to. And yet I'm looking at Patrick Wilson, I'm like, he looks the same as he did in Watchmen, like, 15 years ago or whatever it was.
Yeah, he's still kind of muscular.
Yeah. I think it was in Watchmen, I think he was probably like a 30-year-old, and they're like, they made him be like, you're 40, let's pretend. And then I'm like, okay, sure. Because he still looks like he's 30, or 35, maybe. But anyway, so yes, this exorcism happens, and... there's some complications in it, to say the least. There's the fallout from it, including the presence of, like, someone who was just there as a bystander, but who may have, in fact, contracted some sort of possession.
Yep.
He's a young guy. He's, like, what, 20? Something like that?
Yeah, it's basically the, not fiancé, but I guess boyfriend of the...
The sister of the kid who was possessed.
Right. I was trying to think
and,
that.
And they were like, even, you know, the reason he was there is because he was the boyfriend of the kid's sister. And so...
But he had a pretty good relationship with the kid.
Right. He seemed like he's a good older brother and all that stuff.
That musical interlude brought to you by somebody driving by.
No, I believe that was like Walking By.
Walking By.
An old school blaring his radio guy. Anyway, yes, they begin investigating strange things that happen to this kid. As they come to, he comes to believe he might have like inherited his brother, the younger kid's possession,
right.
Or something. Nick, quick question: did you like it at all?
I liked it, but with a lot of caveats.
Kind of same here. I had ups and downs while I was watching, where I was like, at times I was like, they've dropped the ball. I'm gonna kind of mentally excise this after the first two really quite good Conjuring movies.
Agreed.
But then, kind of by the end, I was like, they kind of had a decent ending. And I was like, I think I can roll with it as being part of the continuity.
They telegraphed a lot.
They did. And there's also and yet at the same time, there's also a lot of stuff that they kind of like never explained, like, wait, why did this happen?
Right.
Or why was this person
and
wanting to...
the inclusion of a certain actor, I was like, oh, well, he's going to tie in really heavily to this because he's a named actor.
Yeah.
It wasn't as like cohesive and concise as Conjuring 1 or 2.
No. Here's the thing. Did James Wan direct both of those?
I believe so.
He had like one of the sort of the best modern horror
and
directors.
This is the director from
like some of the shitty Annabelle side projects or whatever. Or what it was like Curse of La Llorona.
Yeah, Curse of La Llorona. Yes, that was definitely a lesser outing, even though I saw that in theaters.
But I will say, don't you think this was better than that?
It was better than that.
Definitely less than Conjuring's 1 and 2.
Yeah.
But not bad. It had it was pretty watchable, I thought.
I will watch. I'm trying to decide if I would watch, like, the Annabelle movies again before watching this one again.
The third one, Annabelle Comes Home, is that the
one? Oh, I love that one.
With the daughter?
Yep. I legit like
that. Everything I've heard is that's the good
one. That's the only good one. I like this for sure over those, if only because the leads are both good. I like I actually like the police officer that was involved in it. And thought that some of the things that sort of weirdly made me kind of warm to it by the end is that there is that kind of heart that the movies have. Even the sort of like there's a slightly nuanced just little vignette with the cop near the end over an unsolved case or something like that that I thought was sort of sweet. And I was like, oh, I kind of like that these movies have a little bit of heart to them.
I agree. I wish the story had been a little like
Coherent. And also, like, his ability to pull off scares is not as good as James Wan. There's some cheaper jump scares, and they're just not quite as good. But the scene in the morgue and some of those other ones, they weren't without their moments.
Right.
All right, so let's put forth a spoiler warning. If you have not seen Loki Episode 1, we're going to talk about Loki, and we'll probably spoil some stuff, so... Well, this is a good place to close off the podcast. Come back to it later. This is the last thing we're going to talk about.
Yep. Just know that we love you. I wanted to make sure they understood, Randy, the depths of my feelings for them.
Yes, okay. Well, that went to a place I wasn't expecting. So, spoiler warning in place. Let's talk Loki Episode 1. I loved this.
I liked it a lot. Didn't know that I'd been waiting for the TVA to be adapted since I read about them in a Fantastic Four comic in, like, 1990.
These guys have only been in, like, six comics.
Yeah,
they were in a couple issues of Thor.
I think that's where they started.
Did Dan Slott use them at some point She-Hulk?
They probably did show in She-Hulk.
Might have,
But, like, they show up once in a blue moon with some writer who's a nerd.
And they were basically created as kind of a joke. It was like, these are the continuity enforcement guys. The Mobius G. Mobius is Mark Gruenwald.
Yeah.
Right, who was like kind of over at Marvel. Mark Gruenwald was known as sort of the continuity cop. He would sort of keep up with all the behind-the-scenes details and stuff like that. So having him running this intergalactic bureaucracy to police time travel was a meta joke.
Yeah.
But it was funny. It was also like I felt like when Walt Simonson, I think he was the creator, I mean used him in Fantastic Four, that he was riffing a little bit on the kind of darkly comedic bureaucracy of Terry Gilliam's Brazil, which showed, you know, sort of a world that was like cold and sterile because of its bureaucracy and endless desks and all these things. But there was more humor to this that was like less dark and more kind of just kind of fun. But like you cannot like it's a bureaucracy so powerful, even the toughest heroes and villains have trouble dealing with it.
Yeah.
As we will see in this one, the God of Lies cannot worm his way once they capture him.
Man, the reveal about the Infinity Stones cracked me up. And also was a good way of showing, like, oh, we're in a whole different thing now.
Yes. he has is forced to like go through as if he is being processed at like at the DMV or something like that. Mm-hmm. Loki is like given like a jumpsuit. It's also like a prison sort of thing too. And it has to like wait in like interminable like lines in which there's actually no lines, but it's just a long wait anyway. Yeah. And but like if you don't have the right ticket at the right time, you could actually be zapped and incinerated.
Yeah. I thought it was cool that that this Loki is a variant. I mean, they actually were, like, straight out said, variant. The Avengers were supposed to do what they were doing. They were messing
variant
with time.
Variant meaning, for those who, you know, don't remember that in Avengers Endgame, during some of the time travel shenanigans, he kind of escaped. Because otherwise he had been killed by Thanos.
Yep.
Yeah.
But this past version of him was able to escape because he got his hands on a gem and was back off to make mischief and... Only it turns out that they grabbed him.
there's a lot of really funny stuff in this one, like when Loki gets a hold of a little control thing, and like, and the way that they keep like messing with him, like just zapping him in place. And there's a lot of like the funny stuff. But what I was surprised by was that I thought that the emotional stuff worked. Like Loki seeing, this is the thing that it's in Dark World.
Yeah.
That his mother gets killed,
and then it affects him more than he lets on.
But. That we saw in Dark World, though.
Yeah.
The thing that I had not put together that I think they just kind of reframed here is that Loki got her killed.
Yeah.
Right. Basically, I forgot
He was basically he let the Dark Elves go because he thought they'd mess with Thor, and then she got killed, and so in some ways he's responsible. I had not put that together until they showed that here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I remember that either. I thought he was just like a like closet mama's boy.
Well, that's the thing. They don't really make it explicit in Dark World.
Right.
Like, he is the one... When what's it, Curse is going by, I think he tells them where he can find Thor.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Where the throne room is.
Where the throne room is, yeah. And in so doing, he basically put him on a path to kill his mom.
Yeah.
I think that's important that they did that, because given that there's, like, a lot of humor in this, and Loki himself is kind of a heightened character who's sometimes, like, sometimes very wildly villainous, but sometimes dryly humorous, but, like, you need to have some emotional grounding that's real.
Yeah.
And that gave it those moments.
Well, and also I thought... The big question that Owen Wilson, who by the way is great here.
Yeah, I'm not typically a huge Owen Wilson fan, but this is him being some of his best work. Because
I think it is some of his best work as well.
But he's pushing Loki as to what motivation is.
Well, he's like, he's like,
why do you do what you do?
Like, look at this face. Looks like the great thing about this is also meta, but it's done very clever because Loki has been very different in the MCU as well. Like. It's the same thing that happened with, like, Spike in Buffy and Angel, where he started out as just... He was a villain. He was a likable villain, but he was much more... If you go back and watch Thor and Avengers, which I just did, because I'm watching with my son...
Loki's a very bad person. Like, he's a fascist.
He's likable and he's funny, but he casually murders people, and he seems to really relish the pain he's causing people.
He kills Coulson. He wants to take away free will.
Yeah, he kills Coulson. I mean, one of the beloved characters. I thought they might run away from that. But they don't. They, like, straight up show him. They're like, yeah, no, this guy we're asking you to root for, he killed one of your favorite characters.
Yep.
And having Owen Wilson be like, do you enjoy causing pain? Look at that face. It looks like you do. And having the big reveal be that Loki's like, yeah, no, it's part of the illusion. Like, I am weak, and I have to show that I have to be this murderous.
Yeah.
I was showing off for Thanos, essentially, is what he was doing.
Right, and they kind of take it back to some like, I'm trying to remember, do they do that, touch on some childhood stuff bit, too?
They touch a little bit on the fact that he's been cast as a villain.
Right.
I think
they touch a little bit on what had been that Robert Rohde story back then, where it's like, you're there to make other heroes shine around you and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Well, and also see the emotional depth and punch of seeing his father die. His mother die.
Him
Thor,
die.
Thor, yeah, and like the relationship that blossoms with Thor as time goes on.
Yeah.
That sort of is like a wake-up call for him. Like, maybe I don't have to be this way. Yeah. Even though he is a variant that should die.
So that said, the bureaucracy is also, they're like such assholes that when he kind of like finally, like, I actually thought they were maybe going a little too long with showing him continually... like everything he tried, he couldn't get past them.
Oh, I think they needed to do that.
But they did that, and then when he finally gets loose to work some mischief, it's incredibly fun.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And they have a mission for him. Yep. That's going to be the plot of the series.
Yeah. The big reveal. Did you guys see the big reveal coming?
I did not actually.
I guessed it.
I figured it would be some other name or something that would be revealed to later be somebody, but. Are we going to say just go ahead and say what it was?
It's Loki.
It's he himself.
I've heard.
Do we know where this Loki is from?
No, we don't. And it could be a version of him further down the line. There are people speculating that it's going to be the female Loki.
Yep, I've heard that as well.
Which would be kind of fun. We'll see.
And would it be an opportunity to bring in another actor, probably?
Yeah. Also, there is another actress who's been cast.
I thought I was remembering that. Yeah.
Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who I really like. She plays like the judge.
Yep.
And she only has like a couple minutes here, but there's some great interaction with her and Owen Wilson. Do you know the name of her character?
You told me this, and I was like, holy crap.
It's Ravonna.
Yeah, who is...
What's that?
Kang's wife, Ravonna.
Oh, interesting.
And, like, that's kind of a big thing.
Yeah.
I wonder if that means is she going to, like, sell out information from the TVA to Kang? Is he going to turn out to be... Is, like, somebody we've seen already going to be Kang?
Well, and also, like, the TVA is not... They're not necessarily that good. Like, those devices they're leaving, they're wiping out entire timelines. Like, they're not the good guys.
No.
Right.
They're working in the... As Loki knows, like... He's working for like the three space lizards.
Yeah, the three space lizards.
And they're like they're golden timeline or whatever. That's not necessarily a good thing. We know there's going to be a multiverse,
right?
So it's a 6-episode show. I don't know where they're going, but I'm really excited to see where they go with this. I think for me, Falcon and Winter Soldier is the brand of Marvel that I love, like the action adventure buddy comedy. Cap is like one of my favorite characters, and so I was very much like that's my favorite. But this may be the best first episode they've done.
I agree.
I kind of tend to agree too. With Scarlet Witch, it was actually super well crafted, but I was like left kind of like, I don't know what to make of that.
Yeah.
And then with Falcon Winter Soldier, I thought it was quite well done, but I was also like, as it turns out, I was not quite looking for that speed at that point in time, that espionage action.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, somehow, in the same way that there's that kind of energizing humor in Thor Ragnarok, but yet still some, you know, an emotional core and stuff. That they pulled that off, and that ended up winning me over, I guess, over the other premieres, I think. Yeah. We'll see if it can keep it up.
And Tom Hiddleston is so good.
He's really good.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so that'll wrap it up for us this week. We'll be back with more next week, and until that time,
Yo Show!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.